Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The state of South Carolina is pioneering a very interesting project in understanding why some same-sex educational experiments might work, why boys and girls are different in terms of the way they learn, and why having some schoolrooms with boys only and girls only can really make a difference. That state has the only state director for single-gender initiatives. And that is with the South Carolina State Department of Education. That director is David Chadwell, and he is going to be with us in just a few moments. And I'm looking forward to that conversation. I think parents, educators, people who work with youth and children, and frankly anyone who cares about children, ought to be caring about this question. Because the reality is that there has been a bias against single-sex education for a number of decades now. And the reality is that we have not been seeing children, especially boys, learning faster, but rather learning more slowly and getting further and further behind in terms of many of the measures of educational aptitude. We're going to be talking with David Chadwell. We'll find out how this is working, and we'll find out how they got to this point in just a few moments on the Albert Mohler Program. To join that discussion, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Americans complain about being overworked, but a new study indicates that Americans probably are not as overworked as they think. As a matter of fact, it has become a cliche, says Christopher Shea, that the modern labor worker is now very much overworked. The average U.S. citizen, so the conventional wisdom tells us, is overworked, while European counterpoints, the folks working in the same kind of jobs in European countries, get all of August off, much less family leave and all the rest. But a new study at the University of Chicago found that the typical American actually gained the equivalent of 7 weeks of vacation from 1965 to 2003. And this is not so much in terms of actual designated vacation time, but other time off released from work. You know, one of the interesting things that I notice about this kind of study is that it assumes that something like a 40-day work week is standard for human history. Let's just remember that most people had to work as long as it took to get the job done. If you were working on your own farm, and just ask any farmer today, you don't work 9 to 5. You work until the work is done. If you were a blacksmith or if you were a carpenter, you just had to work until the work was done. And even in terms of most of human history, it was clear people worked because the work had to be done. They weren't punching a clock and watching a clock and working by the hour. But this kind of thing in a highly industrialized and now knowledge-based society is monitored, it's marked, it's measured. And so we have people that just assume there's something that's normal. But now we know that Americans think they are working actually more than they are working, which probably tells us something about the human psyche as well. Judy Batista has written an article in the New York Times today in which we find out that Odell Thurman is fighting to get released from his ban from the NFL. She writes, by now, Odell Thurman figured he would be back on a football field to resume his promising career as a linebacker for the Cincinnati Bengals. Those around him say he has gained control of his drinking problem, and he has served a year-long suspension for violating the NFL's substance abuse policy, a punishment that resulted after he was charged with driving under the influence while already suspended. The Bengals could use him, the writer notes. Their season is on the verge of collapse, partly because their defense is so porous. Instead, Thurman, age 24, is at the center of an unusual case that could challenge the sweeping powers the league has to discipline players with substance abuse problems. Now, what would someone in his situation do? I mean, if you're going to fight this kind of suspension, what are you going to do? Well, listen, he has filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, asserting that the NFL declined to reinstate him because officials believe he is an alcoholic. That, his complaint says, violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, which characterizes people as disabled if they have a record of alcoholism and have received treatment. And here we are again in the insanity of a society that has swallowed the poison pill of the therapeutic worldview. Once you begin to assume that all these behaviors are part of some kind of therapeutic worldview, some kind of therapeutic construction and framework, then you assume that people are no longer responsible for their behavior, that it's a part of some kind of syndrome. It's the evidence of some kind of underlying disease, or in this case, a disability. And you just have to wonder about the sanity of a society that begins to redefine all of these behavior-based issues as syndromes and addictions and disabilities, which can leave employers, well, it can leave society at large with no ability actually to regulate behavior or to isolate persons who misbehave. I do not know Mr. Thurman. I have no idea if he has control of his alcohol problem, but there are people close to the situation who would have better knowledge. I do believe that the NFL, or anyone else for that matter, ought to have the right to deal with someone who abuses alcohol on that basis. And as a matter of fact, I think society is likely to hold such an organization accountable for that, even as the person who's being held accountable is going to file a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, charging that the league, in this case his employer, is refusing to acknowledge that he is disabled by alcoholism. Remember, this is a man who is now suspended because he was caught driving under the influence while he was already suspended. Doesn't sound to me like this is an alcohol problem that's demonstrably under control. The Presbyterian Church USA, so a headline in the Louisville newspaper says, is taking up and talking up its missions. Presbyterians are seeking support from congregations across the United States for its mission movement. Let me read to you from the article. The denomination, which cut missionary and other posts because of declining financial support, will be sending 48 mission workers out to tell their stories in the coming weeks in Presbyterian churches, colleges, and other settings. It's an effort to reconnect the local congregations with missionaries and to raise support for missions. By that, we mean prayer support and letters and awareness as well as financial support, said Bruce Werte, an organizer of the Mission Challenge 07 conference. Other observers of the church acknowledge that funding has dropped off, the number of missionary positions has dropped off, but then you read further in the article and you come to this. It describes one of the missionaries, Jacob Goad, age 24, who began working in January with the Peruvian the people in the city of La Oroya, advocating for children and others exposed to lead and other pollution from an industrial plant. He also helped with relief efforts after Peru's massive earthquake this year. And listen to this. While such efforts are different from the direct preaching and evangelism associated with traditional missions, Goad noted that Jesus proclaimed early in his ministry he had come to preach good news to the poor. He was addressing a context of complete inequality in his time, Goad said. Jesus' message is radical and real in our world today where inequality continues to exist. Now, let me just offer an observation here. They call this missions, but in the history of Christian missions, even as other things were being done, good work, social welfare, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, giving water to the thirsty, it was done in order to share the word of the gospel with people who are desperately in need of hearing the gospel of Jesus Christ. The idea of missions is integrally, essentially, inescapably related to a theology of conversion. When you lose or deny or undermine that theology of conversion that holds that persons must come to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ or they will go to hell, then you decouple the idea of missions from any great moral imperative. You see, I believe, as a matter of fact, that there is a great deal of social injustice in the world, and the world is obligated to deal with it as best it can. I believe that, indeed, there are those who are suffering from over pollution and industrial waste and all the rest, and someone ought to pay attention to that. But I don't believe that someone, that some organization, is necessarily the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ, which is assigned as its first responsibility the taking of the gospel. Jesus did not send his disciples out at the end of the Gospel of Matthew to go into all the world and make them social workers, but rather to make disciples. I'm not saying there's no need for social welfare. I'm not saying there's no need for doing good in Jesus' name, but we just need to make sure we're doing it in Jesus' name, understanding that the main task of the church is to get to the gospel. Woe unto me if I preach not the gospel, said the Apostle Paul. I predict that this effort among the mainland more liberal Presbyterians is not going to be very successful, simply because I don't think people in the churches are conceiving of the kind of work described here as missions. They might find an altogether different response if they went to the churches and said, support us financially while we go and try to tell people about Jesus Christ. That would likely, I think, among Christian people, find a very different support. And they can just as well say, we're going to do this, and as we do this, we're going to be doing good in Jesus' name. While you're watching things in Washington, be aware that a House committee voted yesterday to condemn the mass killings of Armenians in Turkey in World War I as an act of genocide. That, by the way, goes almost a century back, 90 years as a matter of fact. I'm not sure exactly what's going on here. It is important that all persons name evil as evil, but there's something eccentric going on when the United States Congress, at least in one House committee, is taking this action 90 years after the act about something that took place halfway around the globe. I fear that a great deal of what is represented here is moral posturing rather than genuine moral statement. We'll be watching this with you, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with a man who leads the Single Sex Initiatives Program for the South Carolina State Board of Education. He's going to be answering the question, why do boys learn better in a single-sex setting, and maybe girls also? This is the Albert Miller Program. The Associated Press reports the story this way. In one classroom, a group of gangly seventh grade boys are sprawled on the floor around a giant vinyl chart using skateboard parts and measuring tape to learn pre-algebra. In a different school a few miles away, middle school girls interviewed each other, then turned in their surveys about who's shy and who has dogs, and they transformed them into fractions, decimals, and percentages. Classical music played softly in the background. Now, there's a picture of some distinction. Boys and girls doing different things, learning what is just about the same subject matter. David Chadwell is the director for Single Gender Initiatives for the South Carolina State Department of Education. He is behind that very picture that was described by the Associated Press, and he's with us now on the Albert Miller Program. Mr. Chadwell, welcome.
Thank you very much.
I am really intrigued by this. We have done several programs on single-sex education. And yet I haven't seen the secular press give such a rosy and positive evaluation as is found in this Associated Press story. You must be doing something unusual there in South Carolina.
Well, I think we have a strong initiative across the state to provide parents with choice. And that's really what single-gender education is. It's an option for parents by federal guidelines. And, you know, it's really an alternative for, you know, the traditional classroom, as well as Montessori schools or language immersion or things like that. And so single gender really has taken off down here in South Carolina with the support of the state superintendent of education.
Well, I find this very interesting. South Carolina is a great state. I was just recently there, and you've got the same kind of issues that I think most state boards of education are going to face. You must have had some support from parents and from the citizens of South Carolina for this experiment.
Yes, there has been a lot of support for this, and there's actually been a lot of fertile ground kind of laid years in advance. We have been involved in a voucher debate for the last 3 or 4 years, and the voucher program has never passed. But because of that, that really has kind of laid the groundwork for alternatives and what are some different possibilities. And so when this single gender has come along and became legal last year, it really started to take root in lots of different communities.
Okay, the Associated Press described these two different settings, two different classrooms, one with, 13-year-old boys on the floor learning pre-algebra with skateboard parts. I love that. Meanwhile, in another school not far away, sounds almost like a fairy tale here, you find girls the same age who are turning in journals about who's more shy and who has dogs, and they're using that same material in order to determine fractions, decimals, and percentages. Two different learning styles there. Is that just an accident?
No, it's not really an accident. It's really done on purpose. And either one could do the same thing. I mean, you could have a group of boys, you know, interview each other and then have them report on items. And that perfectly, you know, that would definitely happen. And girls could certainly plot things out on the ground. What happens is that they, you know, you draw to what tends to be boys' and girls' interest. You try to tap into what they find interesting. And then you are able to have conversations that are much easier and much more open and much more expressive with the boys and with the girls when they are in a single-gender environment. They speak up more. And you can go farther in the topics and in the conversations and with the content area.
Now, one of the interesting things that is often debated related to this question is the question as to whether boys do better in single-sex education. As an educator and as a parent, I'm fairly convinced that would be so. But the related question is, do girls also do better? And one of the things that intrigued me about this article is that the dad that said that his own daughter appears to be doing better in a single-gender educational setting. even as the parents of boys would relate the same. Is that what you're finding?
Oh, boy. I don't know if you can necessarily say that boys do better or girls do better in a single-gender environment. I am starting to see that, you know, really there's benefits to both. I don't think it necessarily is better for one or the other.
Yeah, that's not actually what I asked. I asked, do they both do better?
Oh, do they both do better? Yes, they do. Oh, yes. Yes, boys will do better and girls will do better, and that's in terms of academics. That's in terms of attitude towards school. That's in terms of self-confidence. That's in terms of peer relationships and all of that. And the quote from the parent, the dad, I believe, is not because of his child actually in single gender. That daughter had been in single gender for 3 years and is now in high school and is extremely pleased that she went to single gender in middle school and is happy with the way that she has turned out in comparison to some of her peers that are in her classes now in ninth grade.
Okay, Mr. Chadwell, can you describe how you would arrange the classroom setting differently for an all-boys classroom versus an all-girls classroom? I know this is going to be just an anecdotal example, but set it up for us so we understand different learning styles.
Right. Many times a boys' classroom will be in rows. The desks will be in rows in pairs. So you'll have two boys sitting next to each other. So you might have three rows of pairs. Girls often, if you want them to sit in pairs, you want them to sit face-to-face. So you'll have the desks facing each other. Oftentimes, conversations and activities that girls do seem to work much better when they're sitting face-to-face. Boys' activities, when they're working together, seem to work better when they're sitting side-by-side. You may also have areas in which groups of girls can come together to do work, and that may be, you know, in the back of the room or the side of the room or where they can move the desk together. Guys may want to get up and actually do the work on the on whiteboards that are on the wall. You can get these relatively inexpensive boards and put them up, and they can be standing and working at the board. Some of these things will also work, you know, for girls too, but it tends to be something that, you know, in this case, guys will be drawn towards.
One of the things that caught my attention in the article is how you talked about, or how the reporter actually described a teacher throwing a ball in a boys' classroom so that the boy who's supposed to answer the question is actually catching a ball. In other words, uniting physical movement along with the intellectual activity.
Absolutely. And that's one of the easiest, most common things to do in a classroom of boys, to get them involved in the discussion, and also to somewhat control the discussion. Many times guys will simply all just start calling out and responding to questions that are going on, and you know, you're not sure exactly where you're headed. And so the teacher uses the ball, and it doesn't change the quality of what the guys say, but it's able to focus it and use it better. And it's very simple, and you know, it is motion, and it is the guys focusing on something, and they're able to move around, and they enjoy it. They enjoy classroom discussions more than they did before.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, as the father of a 15-year-old boy, I understand that word focus, and that's what we're all working on. Now, when you start talking about, for instance, setting this up in a state school system, that's I think, so innovative. It catches the attention of the Associated Press, and the particular paper we saw the article in was the Boston Globe, of all things. So now you got people in Boston finding out what's going on in South Carolina. But while we're talking about the differences between boys and girls here, and you're thinking about boys in particular, what I hear is that boys actually are sometimes intimidated by girls being in the classroom because they just assume the girls are always going to do better academically.
That could be. They could, you know, I haven't heard a lot of that. The other part is that sometimes they may just let the girls do things for them if they're in groups. But I have been in many classrooms in which the girls are the ones that sit back and let it go, because the guys are the ones busy answering things and not stopping, just keep on going, and the girls say, okay, well, fine, you know, I'll just let them do it.
Less aggressive,
perhaps. It really varies depending on classroom dynamics, but you can definitely see that one or the other are not reaching their full potential while being in these co-ed classrooms.
All right, we're talking to Mr. David Chadwell. You can join the discussion by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Miller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The question of single-sex education has really begun to become a more common discussion around the country. And if you look back in the history of education, it's not a new idea, not hardly. As a matter of fact, you would find gender-distinct, single-gender schools throughout most of the history of Western civilization. But with the rise of the idea of the common school, and especially with the public schools as engines of producing citizens back early in the 20th century, with the rise of the American high school as the unique factory for producing adolescents and citizens who were expected upon graduation from high school to be ready to take a job, go to war, or whatever, a lot of things changed, and coeducation became the ideal. But especially in the last couple of decades, some of the problems in higher education have also been noted in elementary, primary, middle schools, and high schools, and some interesting experiments are ongoing. Also, we now know more than we once did about the different learning styles of boys and girls. Our expert as our guest today is David Chadwell. He is the United States' first state director for single-gender initiatives. The only state to have such a role is the South Carolina State Department of Education. You can also find out more about Mr. Chadwell's work at his website, www.chadwellconsulting.com. Mr. Chadwell, let me ask you another question. How did you get into this? What's your story?
Oh, back in 2004, the district that I was in is very progressive and started a single-gender magnet program. It already had, I believe, 6 or 7 magnet programs in the district, and this was another one. And it was an opportunity to create the best middle school experience possible. And, you know, I left at that. And single gender was one of those components and that I started to learn more about. And as we started to see it happen in the classroom, really started to see this as a viable alternative to make middle school a better place. And so from there, you know, I just kept on doing more and more with it and really have become quite committed to the concept.
I often wonder why we miss the obvious, and I was at the University of Chicago just last week, picked up a book by Vivian Gusson Paley entitled Boys and Girls. Are you familiar with this book?
No, I'm not.
All right. Well, you need to know it. I didn't know about it either. I was fascinated to find it. It's actually not a particularly new book. It was first published back in 1984, so you know, over 20 years old. Oh. And it's about a woman working with kindergartners, and it's published by the University of Chicago Press. The title is Boys and Girls, and the subtitle is Superheroes in the Doll Corner. And what she talks about is her efforts to treat boys and girls the same and to get them to act alike, and they just won't do it.
Right.
You know, this isn't being published by some kind of esoteric anecdotal press. This is the University of Chicago Press, after all. But she's writing about her experience learning to teach 5-year-old boys and girls. She said this: as I interrupt less, it becomes clear that boys' play is serious drama, not morbid mischief. Its rhythms and images are often discordant to me as a woman, but I must try to make sense of a style that, after all, belongs to half the population of the classroom.
Sure.
And it's just fascinating. She documents the differences here. I have to tell you this. I think you're going to enjoy what I'm going to share with you here. This just real fast, because when you start looking at this, you realize, you know, if you've had a boy and you've had a girl, this is their story. She had them tell stories, and as they told stories, they were supposed to come up with a way to describe their plot. And it turns out the boy's stories and girl's stories are just extremely different. Boys' stories involve doing things, throwing things, shooting things, and girls' stories are very different. Now, if that's true, that should tell us something that educators would find important, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, we go around, and when I do trainings with teachers, we talk about motion for boys, and not only because of their nervous system, but because in the way that their eyes are set up and how they're different than girls. And the impact that that has upon what they write, what they're drawn to, what interests them, and why they do a lot of things they do. I'm not surprised at all by what she writes from what you just quoted to me. That is what people find in classrooms now of all boys, and what they have to do and what teachers need to start accepting. I think you'll find there are some other books that are out there, Misreading Masculinity and Boy Writers, both talk about expanding the literary options for boys.
There are a lot of parents out there that I know find this a great interest, educators too. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Mr. David Chadwell is the Director for Senior Single Gender Initiatives for the South Carolina State Department of Education. Mr. Chadwell, thank you for joining us today on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. To join the conversation about single sex education, boys and girls learning differently, give me a call at 877-893-8255. Why are boys and girls different in their learning styles, and what should we learn from this? The phone number, 877-893-8255. We'll be right back. You know, you start looking at the issue of single-sex education, and one of the questions that comes up is what are the Christian worldview implications of the whole question? I think it's important for us to talk about what does relate to us as we would understand Christian teaching and a biblical worldview to implicate certain decisions, and what's not involved. Well, one of the things that's not involved is whether boys or girls are smarter. That's not the question. Both boys and girls are smart. Boys and girls can do equally well in IQ tests and measures of intellect. That's not in question. The question is not whether it is morally problematic for boys and girls to learn together. That's not an issue either. There's nothing wrong with a coeducational classroom. There's nothing wrong with a coeducational school. That's not the issue. The question is it wrong or would it be right to understand that boys and girls are different? Both made in the image of God, but just as men and women are different, boys and girls are different, not just by socialization, but let's admit, socialization has some impact on that too. Boys have influence on each other. They are monitoring each other all the time, making sure they're acting right, at least by their boy code. Girls are monitoring each other all the time and are catching their signals, one from the other, about you know, how they're presenting themselves and all the rest. I was just given some data just recently talking about how much longer girls take in high school to get ready in the morning going to a coeducational school rather than a single gender school. You know, in other words, if boys are going to be present, they're going to have to look a little different than if there are only girls there. They converse differently. And it was interesting that our guest today was talking, Mr. Chadwell, about if you have a boys' classroom, it's very profitable to put the boys in pairs side by side and to put the girls in pairs facing each other. You remember how many times on this program have I talked about that Stanford University study cited by Time Magazine, a great cover story on boys and girls are different, as if that was headline news, in which they did this study where they bring boys and girls of different ages. They put two boys in the room, two girls in the room, different time. You put the two boys in the room, they take the chairs, put them side by side, and stare at the wall. They talk, but they're not looking at each other locked on. Boys just don't do it that way. They're not into an intimate discussion. They're not sharing their souls. They're talking about cars. Or whatever's the topic of the day. You put two girls in the room, they put the chairs face to face, they sit down, lock those eyes, and go for it. Because they are sharing souls. They are deep into an intimate relationship. The interesting thing is also, you put two boys in a room, they can easily talk to each other if they don't know each other. But if they don't know each other, they're going to talk about something that's a common interest. They can talk about something that's a common hobby. They can talk about something that they've seen in the television or at the movies. That's not a problem. They may leave not knowing the other kid's name. And oddly enough, to the girls in the room, they may leave never asking the other kid's name. Meanwhile, you put the same two girls in the room. They're going to put the chairs facing each other. They're going to lock on according to the study. They're going to talk to each other according to the study. And they're going to leave knowing each other. That's just very different. Boys need physical movement. Just anyone who's had one or has been one understands that. Large muscle movement, it's correlated with the boy's attention and with his focus. What Mr. Chadwell was talking about was taking advantage of that by letting boys do work standing at a whiteboard. Let them stand and be able to write with these erasable markers. Let them do their work that way. Check it on the board. They'll do better standing up, making large muscle movements as they work, rather than sitting with their face, you know, a couple of inches from the desk trying to write on a piece of paper. I think all this just reminds us that God's glory in his creation is always understood, both in terms of what is common and what is distinct. And as Christians, we need to be unembarrassed by both. Boys and girls are both smart. It's right to teach both boys and girls. This is why we should be thankful that our children are not in a nation like something like Afghanistan, where the Taliban didn't allow girls to go to school. That's not what we want. But to say that it's wrong for boys and girls to be educated separately for all or for part of their education, K through 12, is just political. That's the bottom line. The opposition to this is highly political. The opposition to this is coming from feminists who say that separate is always unequal. That's just not right. And as a matter of fact, both can sometimes come out ahead. Now, if it were forced that way, that might be a different issue. I can't envision any state system of schools saying you can't have coeducational schools. You can't choose a coeducational school. But that's not really what's being debated here. It's in many states they're being told you can't choose single-sex education, and the state can't sponsor single-sex education, and I think that's just wrong. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Anyone who's taught children, anyone who's been a youth worker, anyone who's been a parent certainly knows that boys and girls are different. Now, every boy is different from every other boy in some respect. Every girl is different than every other girl in some respect. All human beings are individuals. But as a generalized understanding of the way boys are and girls are, they just learn differently. And I really appreciated something else Mr. Chadwell said, because it's something I hadn't given as much thought to. And that is that boys are sometimes so aggressive and boisterous and loud in a classroom, girls can just be cowered from saying anything. On the other hand, there's also a good deal of evidence demonstrating that boys expect girls to do better academically. Girls are just more into the kinds of things that schools reward. And many people have noted that the elementary school may be the most boy-alienated context in which, throughout his lifespan, a boy or man's ever likely to be in. Because he's been running around, having fun, pushing cars, playing with trucks, playing in the sandbox, chasing a ball, playing with a puppy, playing with his buddies, and then all of a sudden, he's in school. And he's told to sit down, be still, don't fidget, look at the front, pay attention, listen to the teacher, write on the paper. That is a different world for him. And, you know, not recognizing that is a problem. I'm not saying you don't tell boys to do those things in the right context. You just understand this isn't going to come naturally. And if you can take advantage of their learning skills and their learning styles in a different way, you're likely all to be a good deal happier, and he just might come out to a way ahead educationally. The article that was published in the Boston Globe is written by Sienna Adcox of the Associated Press. It's clear that she saw something interesting in this. Leonard Sachs, the founder of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education and the author of the book Why Gender Matters, said no other state has anyone remotely like him. That is our guest today, David Chadwell. It's such an advantage to have a knowledgeable person who's led the format himself in a public school saying this works and this doesn't work. This just might be something like the first shot in a revolution. Because this article says that in South Carolina, 70 schools now offer the program. And the goal is to have programs available to every child in the state of South Carolina within 5 years. Not a force, a choice. Not a mandate, an option. And I think if parents in South Carolina respond to this, as I expect, there are going to be parents all over the country demanding something similar for their children. It's not just, of course, important for the public schools. What about your church and how you do children's ministry and all the rest? Do you understand the difference between boys and girls? What about you as a parent? Good stuff for us to think about. Good stuff for us to talk about. I'll be back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. It's been interesting to have this discussion, and we will continue it. I mentioned this book published by the University of Chicago Press. It's entitled Boys and Girls, Superheroes in the Doll Corner by Vivian Gusson Paley. And it is interesting. She, by the way, taught at the laboratory schools at the University of Chicago. She's written some other books as well. But she writes here about what it was to teach in kindergarten for a year, in which she explored the differences in the ways that children play and children learn, especially the differences between boys and girls. And she really writes some very interesting stuff. It's been a long time since I've had a kindergartner, either boy or girl. I had one of each. But it is fascinating to look at this and just recognize how much is going on. Because the boys, their heroes are superheroes or action figures. They go around the room playing like they're one or the other, speculating on who would defeat whom. And in their free play, The one thing they know is that they're not going to go to the doll corner. That's the subtitle of the book, Superheroes in the Doll Corner. They're not going to be found in the doll corner, which is where the girls are. The girls want to play, and the girls want boys to play, but every time they want the boys to play, they want them to play house. Now, she observes, very interestingly, that if there's only one boy in the room, he'll play house so long as he can play dad. But then the moment another boy enters the room, he is out of the house playing game. And he is doing something else. They write different kinds of stories. She talks about the girl stories, and they're the kinds of things you'd expect. But I think, just in closing here, you might enjoy a couple of the boys' stories. These are five-year-olds. They told stories. Here's one. Once there was Woody Woodpecker. He was making a house. This lady was a bird watcher, and she saw Woody Woodpecker, and she was trying to get him. He said, look, there's a bird. Get on it. So the lady got on the bird, and the bird ate her up. She was dead. The bird tried to eat Woody Woodpecker, but it couldn't. I mean, there you go. A five-year-old boy. There are some people looking at that who'd be ready to think they got the next Columbine shootist on their hand, you know, worried about violence and all the rest. But this kid is just a little boy with a little boy's imagination. You got Wolfman and Dracula and all kinds of people who show up here. And you just start looking at this and you realize that that boys are learning. Yeah, they're learning. Girls are learning. You bet they're learning. But they're learning different things in different ways. And I just think we ought to acknowledge that that is true. Not one superior and one inferior, simply different. And after all, if we deny differences at this age, what are we going to say when we know there are differences yet to come? Tell me about the last time you went to a church fellowship, even if it's of married couples. The women go off in one direction, the guys in another. Not that they don't like each other, they're married to each other. It's just that when they get together, there's some different kinds of conversations going on about different stuff. And that's all right. It's not the end of the story, but that's all right. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.